Well, to speak of the intolerance of tolerance might strike some people as oxymoronic at best, like speaking of the hotness of cold or the freedom of slavery or something of that order. Tolerance today occupies a very high place in Western culture, a bit like motherhood and apple pie in the 1950s. And so to raise some questions about it seems vaguely indecent. It's kicking against the cultural tide. To put the matter in a more sophisticated way, tolerance has become part of the Western plausibility structure. As far as I know, that expression, plausibility structure, was first invented by Berger, Peter Berger, well-known sociologist. He uses it to refer to structures of thought widely and almost unquestioningly accepted in any particular culture. It embraces all the things that the culture judges to be plausible, and they might be very implausible in another culture. For example, in our culture, it's plausible to believe that all religions have the same value or non-value. In the Middle East, nobody believes that. That's not part of their plausibility structure. There's a question of truth. They might disagree over which religion is right, but nobody believes that all religions are basically the same. So there are huge differences in plausibility structures when you go from culture to culture. One of Berger's points is that in tight monolithic cultures, like Japan, let's say, the reigning plausibility structures can be enormously complex. The whole society is webbed together in countless ways, and it's hard for outsiders to break into them. By contrast, in a highly diverse culture, which is what you find in most countries in the Western world, then the plausibility structures are necessarily much more diverse. Or to put it another way, they embrace fewer points for the very good reason that there are not many common elements throughout the entire culture. But those points tend to be held with extra tenacity. At this juncture, it's probably worth pointing out a more recent development. The new tolerance that has developed and is part of Western plausibility structure is not like the old tolerance. That's introducing a distinction that has to be made, the difference between the old tolerance and the new. The new tolerance, I would argue, is dangerous, it is intellectually debilitating, and it is finally enslaving. Even the good that it wishes to achieve, and sometimes does, is in fact better accomplished in other ways. To saunter into the public square and question this new tolerance is a bit like kicking at windmills, but nevertheless it must be done. So let me begin with a distinction between old and new tolerance. Begin with dictionaries. Here's the Oxford English Dictionary. The first meaning of the verb to tolerate is, quote, to endure, sustain pain or hardship. But that meaning is progressively obsolete, to endure pain. People don't talk that way anymore. The second meaning is to allow to exist or to be done or practiced without authoritative interference or molestation. To allow, to permit. Getting closer. Third, to bear without repugnance, to allow intellectually or in taste, sentiment, in principle, to put up with. That's the Oxford English Dictionary. That's the old tolerance, through and through. Webster, similar. Number one, to allow, permit, not interfere with, to recognize and respect others' beliefs, practices, etc., without necessarily agreeing or sympathizing. Even the computer-based dictionary Encarta includes in its list accept existence of different views, to recognize other people's right to have different beliefs or practices. So far, so good. But when we turn to Encarta's treatment of the corresponding noun tolerance, a subtle change appears. Encarta's been out now for 15 or 20 years. Acceptance of different views, the accepting of the different views of other people, for example, in religious or political terms, and fairness toward the people who hold those different views. So, notice the shift. From accepting the existence of different views to acceptance of different views. The first one, where you're accepting the existence of other views, you acknowledge that they're out there and you don't try and persecute them, but you can still argue against them, you can disagree with them. But when you're suddenly accepting those views themselves, then you're not allowed to criticize them anymore. The new tolerance suggests that actual acceptance of another's position means believing that position in some sense to be at least as true as your own. We move from allowing the free expression of contrary opinions to the acceptance of all opinions. We leap from permitting the articulation of beliefs and claims with which we do not agree to asserting that all beliefs and claims are equally valid. I gave some lectures in France not too long ago, where I took the position that it is not true to say that all cultures have the same value. You realize how much that position is contested today? All cultures have the same value. Well, Hitler, for example. Cultures that still pronounce raping boys from the age of 12 on is considered acceptable, which is still going on in many parts of Afghanistan. Is that no better, no worse than the culture surrounding Mother Teresa? Under the older view of tolerance, a person might be judged tolerant if, while holding strong views, he or she insisted that others have the right to dissent from those views and argue their own cases. This view of tolerance is in line with a famous utterance often attributed to Voltaire, though erroneously. As far as I know, Voltaire never said it, but it's a great line. I disapprove of what you say, but I will defend to the death your right to say it. This older view of tolerance makes three assumptions. Number one, there is objective truth out there. And it is our duty implicitly to pursue that truth. Number two, the various parties in a dispute think that they know what the truth of the matter is, even though they disagree sharply, each part thinking that the other is wrong. Number three, nevertheless, they hold that the best chance of uncovering the truth of the matter, or the best chance of persuading most people with reason and not with coercion, is by unhindered exchange of ideas. All of that's implicit in the old view of tolerance. This third assumption demands that all sides insist that their opponents must not be silenced or crushed or persecuted or tortured or jailed or imprisoned. Free inquiry may eventually bring the truth out. It is likely to convince the greatest number of people. Phlogiston, for example, an imaginary substance that chemists once thought caused combustion, will be exposed and oxygen will win. Newtonian mechanics will be bested, and Einsteinian relativity and quantum mechanics will both have their say. You don't squash ideas, you let them run, even if you think that they're stupid. One version of this older view of tolerance, one might call it the secular libertarian version, has another wrinkle to it. In his famous text on liberty, John Stuart Mill, 1806-1873, who has written as much about tolerance and freedom as anyone, opts for a secularist basis to tolerance. In the domain of religion, Mill argues, there are insufficient rational grounds for verifying the truth claims of any religion. The only reasonable stance, therefore, toward religion is public agnosticism and private benign tolerance. For Mill, people should be tolerant in the domain of religion, not because this is the best way to uncover the truth. That's the old view. But precisely because, whatever the truth, there are insufficient means for uncovering it. There's a well-known parable that is cited by almost everybody who writes in this domain. You may have heard of it, but if not, here it is. Gotthold Lessing, 1729-1781, sets his parable in the 12th century during the Third Crusade. The setting is critical to understanding what Lessing's trying to establish by his parable. The setting is a conversation amongst three characters, each of whom represents one of the world's three monotheistic religions. Saladin, on the Muslim side, Nathan the Wise, a Jew, and a Christian Knight Templar. Saladin says to Nathan, "You are so wise. Now tell me, I entreat, what human faith, what theological law has struck you as the truest and the best? And instead of answering directly, Nathan tells a parable. It's a typical rabbinic parable. A man owned an opal ring of superlative beauty and, quite frankly, extraordinary, even magical powers. Whoever wore it was beloved by God, blessed by God, approved by human beings, made his way in culture, attracted money to himself, and so on. He had received it from his father, who had received it from his father, and so on. It had been passed down from generation to generation, from time immemorial. But the time is coming when he must die, and he has three sons, all of whom he loves equally. To whom then will he give the ring? Approaching death, the man realizes that he's got to make some choices, so he secretly asks a master jeweler to make two rings that are indistinguishable from the magic one. And then privately he gives one ring each to one of his boys, so that each of those boys thinks that he's got the magic ring, because the boy doesn't know about the other two. The man dies. And only then do his sons discover that each of the sons had a ring. There were three circulating. And so they began to argue about which one now possessed the original magic ring. In the drama, Nathan the Wise describes their bickering and comments. The brothers investigate, recriminate, and wrangle all in vain. Which was the true original, genuine ring was undemonstrable almost as much as now by us is undemonstrable the one true faith. And so the brothers ask a wise judge to settle the issue. And his wise ruling is, if each of you in truth received his ring straight from his father's hand, let each believe his own to be the true and genuine ring. So the judge urges the brothers to abandon their quest to determine which ring is the magic original. Each brother should instead accept his ring as if it were the original, and in that conviction, lead life faithfully. This would bring honor both to their father and to God. Now, Lessing's parable resonated with 18th century hearers, and it's still retold today as if something profound has been said. The three great monotheistic religions are so similar that each group could happily go on thinking that their religion is the true one. In some ways, something of the same sort of assumptions are operating in the current crisis at Wheaton College. Dogmatism is the enemy. Dogmatism is blamed for bloody wars of the previous century. What was called for, in other words, was religious tolerance. So people today are no less skeptical about claims to exclusive religious truth than were Lessing's readers. They will be inclined to think well of a religion if it produces morally respectable and religiously tolerant adherents. When I was a boy growing up, the best known verse in the Bible was John 3:16. The best known verse in the Bible today is, "Judge not that you be not judged," although nobody remembers where it's from. And they don't remember the context very well. They don't remember that five verses later it says, "Don't cast your pearls before pigs," which means somebody's got to figure out who the swine are. But you know, a text without a context becomes a pretext for a proof text, as my father used to say. Today, I suppose the parable would have to be revised. Instead of three rings, we would need dozens of them, if not hundreds, to symbolize the mutual acceptability of the many religious options, monotheistic, polytheistic, non-theistic. And of course, we could not concede today, as Lessing could, that one of the rings truly was original. But let me tell you frankly, Lessing's parable, as much play as it gets, is nonsense. International class nonsense. Number one, the God figure in the parable, the man with the magic ring, foolishly promises the ring to each of his three sons, even though he knows full well he can't make good on the promise. There's a moral bankruptcy to him. Far from loving his three sons equally, he is presented as a weak fool who makes impossible promises. This isn't an incidental detail in the story. It's the whole point of the story. It is an essential component that sets up why the father goes to the trouble of deceiving at least two of his sons with fake rings. So, has God made impossible and mutually conflicting promises to his disparate sons, ostensibly loving all of them so much that he ends up lying to them? That's the implication of the parable. Number two. The entire parable presupposes that we, the readers, know what God has done. Otherwise, you don't understand the parable. Far from fostering a benign tolerance on the ground that we cannot know which ring is the original, this tolerance is in reality grounded in the dogmatic certainty that God himself has produced fake rings because he cannot bear to disappoint his sons. In other words, the story works only because the reader has this outsider's knowledge of what God has done. Far from advocating a certain kind of epistemological restraint grounded in our ignorance of what God is like, the parable assumes that the reader knows exactly what God is like. He's the kind of father who happily creates counterfeit rings to keep his boys happy and in the dark. Number three. Equally implausible in the story is the way in which the fake rings are physically indistinguishable from the genuine original, yet lacking in the original's power. If over time the original does not produce distinctive blessings owing to its magical properties, its magic is so weak as to be irrelevant. All you have to do is live for 10 years and find out which ring is actually blessing its owner. Did you see? All of that's got lost. The counterfeits, in other words, are not only good copies physically, but they seem to work as well as the original, provided each one thinks the copy is the original, which means the power is not in the ring, it's in the psychology. In other words, we're taken away from a powerful religion that actually transforms people to multiple religions where it does not matter all that much whether one of them is truly powerful or not. What matters is that its defenders think it's powerful. That's what makes them powerful. That is so far removed from any biblical structure of the exclusiveness of Christ that one despairs that people don't see this more clearly. In one respect, however, Lessing's parable is not very contemporary at all. Both Mill and Lessing thought that there is objective truth out there. After all, there is at least one magic ring. But their rationalist and secular presuppositions drive them to infer that at least in some domains, the truth is not accessible. One can think that something or other is true and argue the case, but if one cannot prove that this something is true in a manner that conforms to the verification standards of public science, the wisest stance is benign tolerance. In other words, the older view of tolerance held either that truth is objective and can be known, and that the best way to uncover it is to let people disagree and argue things out in the public arena, since sooner or later the truth will win out, or that while truth can be known in some domains, it probably cannot be known in other domains, and that in those domains, again, tolerance and benign flexibility is the best possible approach. By contrast, the new tolerance argues that there is no one view that is exclusively true. One forgets that the harshest criticism of Christians in the first 3 centuries of the Christian church was that Christians were too exclusive. By far, that was the criticism that got them in most trouble with the Roman Empire. There were lots of pagan religions. They all argued that they were right, but none of them said, and the others are so wrong that you can't be saved. So they argued as to which one was best, but only Christianity came along and said, this is the only way by which to be saved and to come to know God. And for that, they were hated. And that is one of the two fundamental generators of hatred against Christians in the Western world today. Be of good cheer, brothers. We're going back to the early church. Nowadays, we must be tolerant not because we cannot distinguish the right path from the wrong path, but because all paths are equally right or wrong. If we begin with this view of tolerance and then elevate this view to the supreme position in the hierarchy of moral virtues, then the supreme sin is intolerance. The trouble is that such intolerance, like the new tolerance, also takes on a new definition. Intolerance is no longer a refusal to allow contrary opinions to say their piece in public, but must be understood to be any questioning or contradicting the view that all opinions are equal in value. For such questioning, there is no tolerance whatsoever. It is classed as intolerance and must therefore be condemned. Intolerance has become the supreme vice. This is becoming enmeshed in public documents. Here's the United Nations Declaration of Principles on Tolerance, 1995. Tolerance involves the rejection of dogmatism and absolutism. Do you hear that? Why? Might one not hold a certain dogma to be correct and to hold it absolutely, while insisting that others have the right to hold conflicting views to be dogmatically true? Indeed, the statement, tolerance involves the rejection of dogmatism and absolutism, sounds, well, a wee bit dogmatic and intolerant. It's the built-in contradiction is so obvious, it's shocking that most people don't see it. Here's Helmbrook, Executive Vice President of the National Lambda Chi Alpha Fraternity. The definition of the new tolerance, notice that the new tolerance defenders speak of it as new tolerance. I haven't made that up. I've inherited it. The definition of the new tolerance is that every individual's beliefs, values, lifestyle, and perception of truth claims are equal. There is no hierarchy of truth. Your beliefs and my beliefs are equal, and all truth is relative. But if, however, the new tolerance elevates all values and positions as worthy of respect, one may reasonably ask if this includes Nazism, Stalinism, child sacrifice, the respective stances of the Ku Klux Klan, and other groups. All to be accorded equal respect? If not, why not? In the autumn of 2007, Donald Hinley, a sociology professor at Brandeis University, lecturing on Latin American politics, told his students that Mexican immigrants in the U.S. used to be called wetbacks. That bare fact can't be contested. In fact, when in 1954 the Eisenhower administration attempted to repatriate more than 1 million illegal Mexicans, the official name of the project was, government documents, Operation Wetback. In today's environment, however, a student complained because he had used the word, even though he was using it not to call illegal Hispanics today wetbacks, but to survey the actual history. In the kerfuffle that followed, two students apparently said that Hinley's remarks were more than an explanation of a historical fact. At the time, Hinley had been lecturing for 48 years with no previous recorded complaint. After prolonged administrative to-ing and fro-ing, the university found Hinley to be guilty of ethnic harassment and imposed a classroom monitor on him to ensure his speech was never out of line, all without granting him a formal hearing or putting the charges in writing before reaching the verdict. Unwilling to be labeled guilty of such harassment, Hinley fought back. He filed suit, and in due course, Brandeis University caved. But it was after two or three painful years. In the medical field, it's hard to remember that a few decades ago, doctors took the Hippocratic Oath, which includes explicit clauses against taking life, understood to forbid both abortion and assisted suicide. Nowadays, all the medical schools have dropped those clauses. But it's more complex than that. The story doesn't end there. Doctors, nurses, and other medical professionals who still want to live under the constraints of the Hippocratic Oath because of beliefs that prevent them from performing or participating in what are now legal but still ethically controversial acts find themselves in a strange situation. More and more pressure is being exerted on them either to act in violation of their conscience or to abandon medicine. Now, I'll come back to that one this afternoon in The Woman from Kentucky. Stick that one in the back of your head. the rising number of Muslims in England has prompted subtle and not so subtle eviction of pigs. In some schools, the story of the three little pigs is now banned, as Muslim school children might be offended by stories about unclean animals. But my favorite story concerns the Council of Dudley in Worcestershire, West Midlands. My wife is from the Midlands. Where they banned all images or representations of pigs from its benefits department on the ground that Muslims coming in for benefits might be offended. Calendars with pigs, porcelain, porcine figurines, pig-shaped stress relievers, spongy things that you squeeze, you know. All had to go, including a tissue box depicting Winnie the Pooh and Piglet. When pressed as to why pigs have to go, Mahbubur Rahman, a Muslim counselor in West Midlands, explained, "It's a tolerance of people's beliefs." That's stunning doublespeak. What about tolerance of those who think differently about pigs? In the name of tolerance toward the beliefs of Muslims, intolerance is imposed. In this instance, as one media outlet has put it, tolerance has, on the lips of Mahbubur Rahman and in the decisions of the Dudley Council, become confused with Islamist supremacism. In the name of tolerance. No one should doubt that Muslims ought to be free to express their dislike of pigs and pig representations. The problem, rather, is that Mr. Rahman thinks that getting rid of pigs and pig representations is a moral obligation that upholds the virtue of tolerance, whereas he senses himself under no obligation to uphold the virtue of tolerance and permit those who rather like pigs than the representations of them. You multiply this sort of confrontation 100 times, throw in a small but significant number of vociferous imams, and one suddenly understands why a whole culture can be taken over in the name of tolerance because of such selective targets. Or visit the website of the Harvard chaplains. I did so a few years ago when I wrote the book. I checked it again more recently. Not all religious groups join the United Ministry organized by the Harvard chaplains, so the chaplains feel it's necessary to warn against, quote, certain destructive religious groups who are not part of the United Ministry. The chaplains, quote, are committed to mutual respect and non-proselytization. But suppose that your religion demands proselytization, then you can't be part of the United Ministries. We affirm the roles of personal freedom, doubt, open critical reflection in healthy spiritual growth. We're here to help you have a healthy, happy experience of your own spiritual journey while you're here at Harvard. I wonder if they think that's why Jesus came. To help us have a healthy, happy experience in our own spiritual journey. The chaplains warn against other things, those who claim, quote, a special relationship to God, end quote, and especially anything that qualifies as ego destruction, end quote, read sin. Or, very recently, did you see the post by the university president of Oklahoma Wesleyan University? Brilliant. He had somebody complain, one of the students complain, that a chapel speaker, working through the Lord's Prayer, if you please, had made him feel bad. It made him feel bad because he was not living up to the standards that the chaplain was laying out from Scripture. And therefore, this chaplain was clearly intolerant and had to be disciplined. Well, mercifully, the Oklahoma Wesleyan University president posted something online that is already a classic. How many of you have read it? Oh, a good number, 12 or 15. After this is over, go and look it up. Google it. Oklahoma Wesleyan University, and you'll find it. And basically what he says is what you call feeling uncomfortable is what the Bible calls guilt. You're supposed to feel guilty because you are. And that becomes an incentive for changing your behavior. If you don't want to feel guilty, I suggest you don't go to a Christian university. And so on, things along those lines, you see. It doesn't seem like rocket science to me, you know? But it's part of what is going on everywhere in the country. Michel Houellebecq is one of France's most respected, if least comfortable, contemporary writers. I was brought up in French, so I'm always interested in the French side of my background. His tone is that of a younger Albert Camus, if you read some Camus. He was charged about a decade ago and taken to court by four leading Muslim bodies in France. The charge was making a racial insult and inciting religious hatred. This arose because in a magazine interview he made some derogatory comments about Islam. He dismissed Islam as, quote, the dumbest religion, end quote, and unfavorably compared the Quran with the Bible. The former, he said, is poorly written, while the Bible is at least beautifully written because the Jews have a heck of a literary talent. It was not that he was defending things from a Christian point of view. It was a purely literary judgment, you see. In the court case that followed, several prominent French intellectuals defended Houellebecq, but not a few sided with his accusers. The influential Human Rights League accused him of Islamophobia. Many leftist writers insisted he was so vulgar he was not worth defending. But perhaps the most astute comment came from Salman Rushdie, who knows something about what it means to arouse Islamic ire. He wrote in The Guardian, "But if an individual in a free society no longer has the right to say openly that he prefers one book to another, then that society no longer has the right to call itself free. Presumably any Muslim who said the Quran was much better than the Bible would then also be guilty of an insult, and absurdity would rule. As to the dumbest religion phrase, well, it's a point of view. And Houellebecq, in court, made the simple but essential point that to attack people's ideologies or belief systems is not to attack the people themselves. This is surely one of the foundation principles of an open society. Citizens have the right to complain about discrimination against themselves, but not about dissent, even strongly worded impolite dissent from their thoughts. There cannot be fences erected around ideas, philosophies, attitudes, or beliefs." And eventually the court ruled the way that it needed to. Less than 10 years ago, Noah Reiner, then president of the Dartmouth Student Assembly, spoke at a convocation welcoming freshmen to the campus. Traditional responsibility of the student president. He said that the acquisition of knowledge is less than what they should be striving for. The development of character is a more important goal. Then he added, quote, "Character has a lot to do with sacrifice, laying out personal interests, putting them down for something bigger. The best example of this is Jesus. He knew the right thing to do. He knew the cost would be agonizing torture and death. He did it anyway. That's character." Inevitably, a controversy blew up. One of the student body wrote to Reiner, "I consider your choice of topic for the convocation speech reprehensible and an abuse of power. You embarrass the organization, you embarrass yourself." On the other hand, a Jewish student wrote, "Many of us in the Dartmouth community proudly disagree with that and other aspects of Reiner's religious beliefs, but our disagreements do not give us the right to limit his speech." That's rare today. One of the most insightful reflections on the brouhaha came from Reiner himself, who wrote, "The problem is not that Dartmouth has a formalized speech code. That would be easy to deal with and easy for students to break. Students can always get around codes. The problem is that Dartmouth has a speech culture, where some topics are off limits and some perspectives shouldn't be uttered. In other words, in this tolerant world, some things are intolerable. Especially those judged to be intolerant by others. Dartmouth College, of course, is the same institution which, several years earlier, forbade Campus Crusade from distributing 1,000 copies of C.S. Lewis's Mere Christianity, on the grounds that it might offend some non-Christian students. Note well, the banned publication was not pornography, which would have been permitted, nor instructions on how to make a bomb, or a book on pedophilia, or lessons on anarchy, all of which would have been permitted. This book was a rather mild Christian apologetic, first delivered as lectures on British radio during World War II. Eventually, Dartmouth was forced to withdraw its objections. But the fact that it would even go there is scary. If you read The Atlantic Monthly about four issues back, there was another long essay on the intolerance of student culture today. that's worth reading as well. Now, what's important to see, I think, here is this. In the past, under the old tolerance, tolerance was understood to be a parasitic virtue. That is to say, a virtue that depends on an entire structure of other virtues. And then tolerance becomes the virtue that allows people to disagree with that structure. So it's a parasitic virtue in that there has to be a whole structure out there. So the ancient Romans had a certain view of tolerance, but there was also a Roman plausibility structure. Things that were permitted, things that were not permitted, and so on. And then the question becomes, in any totalitarian regime, even in any democratic regime, it becomes, how far can people go outside the plausibility structure before they're arrested or silenced or their opinions are not published or whatever. But that means that tolerance as a virtue, seen to be a good thing to allow opinions to flow, is parasitic on a bigger virtue system. It's a parasitic virtue. But secondly, what has happened in recent times, especially in the West, is that the new tolerance has itself become the ultimate virtue. In other words, not only is there a new definition of tolerance, but it's no longer a parasitic virtue. It's become the supreme virtue, and thus has become incoherent. Moreover, in the third place, historically speaking, it's worth pointing out again and again and again that historically, the claims of some that religion is the worst offender, the worst, most guilty party, guilty of intolerance, is historic nonsense of the first water. In the 20th century, was it the Christians who tried to kill 6 million Jews? Was it Christians who killed about 20 million Ukrainians? Was it Christians under Mao who got rid of approximately 50 million Chinese and so on? It's largely been cultures that have been overtly atheistic, like Stalinism, or functionally atheistic, often with some sort of superficial appeal. In other words, the range and possibility of intolerance, once you start pushing these sorts of suppression of freedoms, is frightening in the extreme. One of the clearest thinkers in this respect, I think, is Darrell Charles. Let me read a long paragraph. Tolerance, in its conception, took on the cast of a virtue because of its concern for the common good and its respect for people as persons. We endure particular customs, behaviors, or habits, sometimes even relatively bad habits, of people in the interest of preserving a greater unity. In the Lockean context, that is the context of John Locke, whom I quoted earlier, tolerance was advocated for religious nonconformists. Never was it construed, however, to imply, much less to sanction, morally questionable behavior. Consider, however, the devolution of a concept. What was a public virtue in its prior state becomes a vice if and when it ceases to care for truth, ignores the common good, and disdains the values that uphold a community. The culture of tolerance in which we presently find ourselves is a culture in which people believe nothing, possess no clear concept of right and wrong, and are remarkably indifferent to this precarious state of affairs. As a result of this transmutation, tolerance becomes indistinguishable from an intractably intolerant relativism. That's exactly right. The challenge facing people of faith is learning how to purify tolerance so that it remains a virtue without succumbing to the centripetal forces of relativism and the spirit of the age. That's the end of the quotation. The new tolerance then has become the supreme virtue, if not something stronger than that, of much of Western culture and beyond. No longer is it a function of a broader ethical and moral cultural consensus. Tolerance is not worked out in terms of what might be permitted, legally, intellectually, socially, but rather becomes an absolute good that gains the power to erode other cultural distinctives, including moral and religious distinctives. In the mind of many observers, this new tolerance thereby rushes in to support moral relativism. Because of its independent status, this new tolerance becomes, ironically, a moralizing support of moral relativism. In addition to the ways these changes are developing in Western culture, we need to be aware of how people in other cultures read our changes. In his book, Why the Rest Hates the West, Understanding the Roots of Global Rage, have you seen that book? It's worth reading as well. It's about 10 years old now, but still worth reading. Make Pierce spells out how this new understanding of tolerance is perceived to be a threat in other cultures. Quote, the currency of the term tolerance has recently become badly debased. Where it used to mean the respecting of real hard differences, it has come to mean instead a dogmatic abdication of truth claims and moralistic adherence to moral relativism. Departure from either of which is stigmatized as intolerance. Where the old tolerance allowed hard differences on religion and morality to rub shoulders and compete freely in the public square, the new variety wishes to lock them all indoors as matters of private judgment. The public square must be given over to indistinctness. If the old tolerance was at least a real value, the new intolerant tolerance might better be described as an anti-value. It is a disposition of hostility to any suggestion that one thing is better than another, or even that any way of life needs protected space from its alternatives. The result is that this new tolerance tends to stifle and subdue the distinctive claims of other cultures. Let us remember that President Obama, before he became president, and Hillary Clinton as well, publicly and repeatedly espoused marriage as being the legal union of a man and a woman, and disavowed the legitimacy of homosexuality. Well, we all know that they've changed their mind, but that's not what interests me. People can change their minds. What interests me is that increasing pressure is exerted by them in their respective spheres to get other people to change their minds along with them. So that today, increasingly in Ethiopia, for example, where I have plenty of contacts, in Ethiopia today, the American government is constantly threatening to withhold fiscal support unless the Ethiopian government starts softening its stance against homosexuality. So here is not only a change of mind, but such a change of mind that is using the weight and power of American aid in order to subvert the chosen course of so-called third world nations, developing world nations. And all in the name, if you please, of tolerance. It's not only personally intolerant, it's exerting power in the international business of world politics, geopolitical concerns, in the name, if you please, of tolerance. According to countless internet reports, the last decade has seen filmmaker Rob Reiner, a co-founder of Castle Rock Entertainment, come out so strongly against smoking that anyone who wants to depict smoking in a Castle Rock film must first meet with Reiner and provide a convincing justification. Reiner has repeatedly been reported to have said, quote, movies are basically advertising cigarettes to kids, end quote. In other words, with the rarest of exceptions, he refuses to tolerate smoking in the films that his company produces. And I say, good on you, Rob. But why doesn't he take a similar stance with respect to casual sex? Gratuitous violence, blasphemous language. The defense, of course, is that Hollywood's depiction of such conduct does not cause similar behavior. And besides, it would be intolerant to censor the depiction of alternative ways of living. But then why does Reiner think that depicting smoking so advertises the habit that young people are induced to smoke? Why censor smoking? How is it the moral high ground to be intolerant about depicting smoking and to be tolerant when depicting gang rape? My favorite recent example from the last decade, I think, concerns Dennis Prager. Dennis Prager is a Jewish radio talk show host. And he's on the conservative wing of things, and he's always saying wonderfully outrageous things. Commenting on developments at Duke University, which, of course, as you will know, is associated with the United Methodist Church, he notes that since 1853, at the baccalaureate service, Duke gave a free copy of the Bible to all participating graduates. At the end of the 90s, however, Jewish factions and students at Duke protested that it was offensive to Jewish students to be given a book that includes the New Testament. By way of response, Duke University decided that henceforth Bibles would not be given out, but would be stacked in a separate room where students could go and take one if they wished. Prager comments. To summarize the situation in even simpler terms, Duke, Jewish faculty and students, and Jewish institutions at Duke object to Jewish students participating in a service where Duke offers a gift of a Bible that contains their own Jewish Bible and also the New Testament, where any participant is free not to take that Bible, at a service that is entirely voluntary, in a university that is private and affiliated with a Methodist church. One of the best words to describe this attitude is actually a Hebrew-Yiddish one, chutzpah. Another word might be ingratitude. We American Jews are probably the most fortunate Jews in Jewish history. We live the freest, most economically secure lives in Jewish history in a country that not merely tolerates our religion, but has always honored it. And who made such a country possible? Men and women, nearly all of whom were Christian, who regarded Judeo-Christian values as the basis of this society, even as many of them fell short in these values. In our specific case, it was not Jews who made Duke University. It was Christians, indeed, a specific Christian church. Instead of being grateful to the tradition that created their country and their university, some Duke Jewish faculty and students have decided that they are offended by it. The Jews of Duke have undermined the Judeo-Christian and Western cultural foundations of American culture and of their university. And for what? So that Jewish students not hold a Bible containing Christian scriptures. How sad. Apparently, multiculturalism and tolerance don't apply to Christians. The inconsistency is built into so many, many, many institutions nowadays. When a Danish newspaper published cartoons of Muhammad and people died in the upheaval that followed, much of the discussion in the media turned on the debate between two competing values, tolerance of the new sort. After all, didn't the cartoonist bring this on himself because he was not being sufficiently sensitive, you see, to the feelings of Muslims? And freedom of expression. Shouldn't we preserve the freedom to publish whatever we want, even if it skewers some sacred cows? That was the debate. But once again, we must see that what is being advocated on the tolerance side is not the old tolerance. The old tolerance would have insisted that both Muslims and Christians have the right, indeed the obligation, to criticize the other party, including by means of satire and cartoons. They can laugh at Christ and we can laugh at Muhammad. I'm not recommending it as a style, but if you're talking about freedom, it needs to be even-handed. But more important, the old tolerance would have insisted that both Muslims and Christians have the right, indeed the obligation, to criticize the other party. The Danish cartoonists were not jeopardizing the freedom of expression of Muslims, still less their right to worship and propagate their faith. So when Muslims respond with violence and threats of assassination, it was they who were being intolerant, under the old understanding of tolerance, not the publishers of the cartoons. Only by falling under the sway of the new tolerance could the charge of intolerance be attached to the cartoonist and his publisher. And meanwhile, by reducing their attachment to freedom of expression, many voices, especially in fear because of the threats, became themselves less tolerant of those who wanted to maintain freedom of expression. Well, there are so many examples. The thing has gone way beyond inconsistency. Consider the statement. Sexual relations between two human males is wrong. Now, two people might well disagree over the truthfulness of this statement and still not be relativists. For instance, they might both hold that the Bible is God's authoritative word and that it establishes an external objective standard on this matter, but they might disagree as to what the Bible says. That wouldn't make them relativists. It would mean that one is right and one is wrong. Relativism arises when there is no standard, or when the standard is said to exist but we cannot know what it means. Perhaps the saddest and certainly the ugliest relativism is found when a kind of pragmatic relativism holds sway. We acknowledge the standards but insist on doing things our own way. In much the same way that we can have a pragmatic atheism. We know that God exists but we act as if he doesn't. Relativism is the view that no one standard of true and false, right and wrong, good and bad, beautiful and ugly, exists that is valid for everyone. Relativists may be happy to talk about my truth and your truth, but they rarely talk about the truth. Convictions and conduct flow not from some objective standard, but from personal or communal standards. Pragmatic relativists exist in every culture. Consider Matthew 21, 23 to 27, where Jesus' opponents will not face the truth and so find ways to duck it. If we say this, he'll say that. If we say so they duck. Do you see? That's a pragmatic relativism. It's not based on any strong conviction other than self-promotion and self-defense. The tragic reality of our generation in the West, well, certainly not everywhere in the world, is that we have codified and authorized relativism to such a degree that interest in truth and morality and integrity alike has largely dissolved. That's the price we're paying in the culture. There are some virtues like self-sacrifice that are sometimes held up, self-deprecation and humor that are sometimes held up, but no virtue is adequate to cover over the multitude of sin and shame and guilt if the same party is judged on any of these particular fronts to be intolerant. But from the perspective of the Bible, if you're a Christian, relativism is treason against God. That the God of the Bible exists establishes the possibility of truth. That he is a self-revealing God establishes the possibility of knowing that truth. Relativism regularly plays games with language, encourages doctrinal aberration, cultivates duplicity, and pretends to be humble while authorizing astonishing arrogance. Relativism promises freedom but enslaves people. It refuses to acknowledge sin and evil the way the Bible does, and therefore it never adequately confronts sin and evil. And therefore leaves people enslaved by sin and evil. At societal levels, it is an invitation to intolerance. Millions call themselves pro-choice in the matter of abortion. But that is surely coherent for them because abortion itself is viewed as morally neutral. And therefore, the choice is devoid of moral significance. They're pro-choice because either side is acceptable. The choice is devoid of moral significance except for its availability to the sovereign freedom of the individual will. Small wonder then that we have arrived at the place where our medical experts can help generate life in the womb and then kill a baby about to emerge from the womb with no moral differentiation. It's a matter of personal choice. This is where the cultural analyses of Charles Taylor are particularly striking. His fat book, he's a Canadian cultural commentator and philosopher, is called A Secular Age, about 900 pages or so. It's not an easy book to read. If you want a soft way in, read James K.A. Hunter, How Not to Be Secular, published by Erdmans, which is essentially a summary of Taylor. He points out that the term secular is actually capable of quite a lot of different readings. Most people have come to see that secularism does not squeeze religion out. It squeezes religion to the periphery of life so that religion is not important. Religion that once controlled all of life is reduced to the private sphere. So it has no moral constraint in the culture at large. You can be ever so religious, so long as it doesn't have any bearing whatsoever on cultural pronouncements or legal enforcements. No. In this secular age, however, what is at the core of it, according to Taylor, is what he calls the age of authenticity. By that he means you are judged authentic if you live in line with what you yourself personally choose. So if you choose some form of self-sacrifice, or you choose to go into the military, or you choose to do whatever, and that's what you really do want to do, not because you're squeezed by your family or your culture or your spouse or whatever, but that's what you freely choose, and then you live in the line with what you choose, you're authentic. That's the supreme good. So if you choose to undergo transgender operations, then that's a good thing intrinsically, because you're living in line with your choices. In other words, what guarantees authenticity is that you live in the line of what you choose. So choice, understood in the most absolute set of terms, is open entirely, with no thought given, for example, to whether or not there is some constraint because of social obligations. What obligations do you have to your family, to your children, to your community, to your village, to your town, to heritage, to your race, to your nation, to politics, to social justice? What obligations do you have to history? What obligations do you have to the promises you made? If everything is open to choice, with none of those things allowed to make any direct impact for you to be authentic, do you see? Then the name of the game is the most astonishing self-focus that has ever existed in the history of the world. I've been doing university missions now for 35 years. And during that time, I've seen quite a lot of changes of one sort or another. Today, there are a couple of questions that I invariably get that I never got 30 years ago. One of the questions that I get at just about every university mission today now is, why does God want all the glory? He really is an egocentric son of a gun, isn't he? You know, he expects all peoples to praise him. You even sing hymns and songs and stuff that talk about how important it is to praise him. Well, as far as all of our relationships are concerned, if we're in a group and one person always wants to be the center of attention all the time, we know what to do with them, you know? They're just megalomaniacs, don't want to have anything to do with them. So why is it that your God is always so megalomaniacal? I don't know how many times I've had that question in the last 10 years. But that's not the one that interests me the most for our purposes now. There are two points at which today's university students get angry at me. You see, in some ways, it's easier to do university missions today than it was 10 years ago, 15 years ago. Because the new generation is so bone ignorant, they're not rebelling against Christianity anymore. They don't know enough to rebel. When I was in university, there were a lot of people that were still so Christianized that they were rebelling against it. If you were dealing with an atheist, he or she was a Christian atheist. That is, the God in which he or she disbelieved was the Christian God, which still meant that the categories are on my turf. Do you see? You can't presuppose that nowadays. Now, instead, you find some people who call themselves Christians who have no idea what the Christian God looks like. And there are all kinds of people who have no... They've never held a Bible. They don't know the Bible has two testaments. I mean, the biblical illiteracy is spectacular. Once in a while, I succumb to temptation and agree to do one of these things on cable television where they're talking about religion in some respects. You know, I go off and shoot something for a couple of days. And one of them showed up a few years ago for this Discovery Channel where they wanted me to go and be one of the Christian voices giving their perspective and so on. So for 2 days I was at this shoot, And during that time, I think I talked to everybody on the crew. There were about 30 of them, or 32 by the time you have your sound guys and your video guys and the supporters and the secretaries and the gophers and all the rest. You know, there were probably 30 or 35 people there. I think I talked to all of them over the course of 2 or 3 days. Not one of them knew that the Bible had 2 testaments. The only exception was the woman who was tasked to interview me. She flounced up to me with great pleasure and a warming smile on her face and said, "I'm so glad to meet you. I've been studying the Bible now for 6 weeks and I think I've really got a handle on it." Boy, was I impressed. But you see, the advantage of that is that they're not mad at me because I'm a Christian anymore. They don't know enough to be mad at me. They don't know what beliefs I hold that are going to insult them. So in one sense, as I say, university missions are a lot easier than they used to be because people are so bone ignorant. There are other reasons why they're easier. We got more Asians, and Asians are culturally more conservative. But that's another issue that I won't even go into. But there are 2 points where students will get mad at me every time. If I'm talking about the deity of Christ and trying to explain something about the Trinity, is that what you believe? It's a bit strange, but okay, if that's what you say, Christians believe. Yeah. The resurrection from the dead? Well, it's hard to believe, but okay, if that's what Christians believe, whatever you say. No. There are 2 points and 2 points only where they get mad at me. Number one, when I talk about sin. Then Taylor's Age of Authenticity rears its ugly head every time. Who gives you the right to tell me what's right and wrong? We're really authentic if we do what we really, really want, what we feel we're called to do and to be, and so on, so on, so on. So the problem is, of course, you can't get across a faithful conception of the gospel unless you get across a faithful conception of sin. Unless you have a well-fleshed-out biblical grasp of what sin is, the problematic of the Bible storyline, you can't get a well-fleshed-out grasp of what the gospel is, which is what confronts sin and addresses sin. Of course, Tim Keller's writings have sometimes helped us by getting us to focus on idolatry before we cross the line to transgression and other things. But nevertheless, it is a barrier you've got to cross. The other thing that gets them mad at me is any suggestion, let alone bald-faced assertion, that this is the only way to God. It's the exclusiveness of the claim that is offensive. And that brings us to the heart of a great deal of the muddle generated by the new tolerance. One of the finest brief statements of relativism of which I'm aware is an address by John Piper called The Challenge. The Challenge of Relativism. It was delivered at a Ligonier conference about 7 or 8 years ago, subsequently developed. Piper begins by asking, how is the bad thing called relativism different from good ways of thinking relatively? In other words, we may conclude that someone is tall or short relative to another person. That's a useful way of thinking. It's not indispensable, but it's useful. We think in relative terms about all kinds of issues. How can we distinguish between those ways of thinking about things relatively in an admirable way and succumbing to relativism in a really negative vein, judging by biblical standards? Relativism, he says, is different. For moral relativism to exist, one or more of the following statements must be true. Number one, there is no external or objective standard of truth. Number two, the standard may be out there, but we cannot know it. You see, that's going back to debates in the 18th century. Number three, the standard is out there, but we cannot know what it means. That's the hermeneutical jiggle. Number four, the standard exists and we know what it means, but we simply do not care. One or more of those four statements must be true for relativism, in the evil sense, to exist. Relativism arises where there is no standard, or where the standard is said to exist but we cannot know what it means, or where, in fact, we've adopted a kind of pragmatic relativism. We acknowledge the standards exist, but insist on singing with Frank Sinatra, "I Did It My Way." The effect of this change is striking. It used to be that moral issues held a central place in public discourse, and part of that discourse dealt with how much deviation from those moral standards could be tolerated, the old tolerance. Increasingly, however, the rights and wrongs of the old moral issues receive scant attention, while the public discourse focuses on what sanctions should be imposed on those who do not tolerate the abolition of what were once the moral standards. Or if we talk about oughts in public discourse, then they are the oughts of pragmatism. That is, if we do this, will this improve the economy, or will it hurt the economy? It's all judged by pragmatics. Undoubtedly, the test case today is homosexuality. I would love to say much more about that, but I'm going to pass on. Let me mention just a few things in passing. One of the most difficult and complex issues to face when you deal with homosexuality is what makes a person a homosexual. Fifty years ago, throughout the Western world, homosexuals who were arguing for their position argued that it's a matter of choice. They wanted the right to choose their own way. And that is still at the heart of queer theory today. That's their terminology, queer theory. In other words, homosexuals don't defend homosexuality on the same ground everywhere. The self-designated queers defend it on the ground of freedom. They tend to have a libertarian streak. But more common today is the view that you're born this way. And if you're born this way, how can you say what's right or wrong? Few have matched the care and objectivity of the study by Stanton Jones and Mark Yarhouse. It's now a little old. It's been updated. Their book is called Homosexuality, the Use of Scientific Research in the Church's Moral Debate, 2000, which analyzes all of the theories of what causes homosexuality, psychological, familial, genetic, smaller hypothalamus, and so on, so on, so on, and show that there really isn't a clear-cut answer to these questions. There are just too many unknowns out there, and that even science itself is learning to hold its tongue on these matters. And in any case, even if at some point it were tied to a specific gene or the like, that wouldn't overturn the church's commitment to what the Bible says is right and wrong in this regard, because one of the things that has certainly gone wrong in this world, this side of the fall and the curse, is genetic breakup. So my intention, again, is not to document the way evidence is regularly presented in highly manipulative fashion. Rather, the problem is how the media regularly blacken the character of anyone who entertains the possibility that homosexual behavior is not a good thing. One remembers, for instance, that when President Bush proposed James Holsinger for the post of Surgeon General, someone discovered that 20 years earlier, Holsinger had voted with the majority of the United Methodist Judicial Council to continue the ban on ordaining practicing homosexuals. The Boston Globe demanded that Bush withdraw the nomination of Holsinger since, quote, no one should go into the job with a record of discriminating against people because of their sexual orientation, end quote. The Washington Post was derisive. At no point was the issue of homosexual practice itself seriously discussed. Rather, all the focus was on the intolerance of Holsinger. In the name of tolerance, his appointment was not tolerated. Again, more recently, less than 5 years ago, Kenneth Howell found himself in difficulty with the University of Illinois at Champaign-Urbana. At the time, Howell was both director of the Newman Center's Institute of Catholic Thought and adjunct professor of the university, and he was teaching a course titled, quote, Introduction to Catholicism and Modern Catholic Thought, end quote. In response to discussion in the classroom regarding homosexuality, on the 4th of May of 2010, he distributed a 3-page email to his own students clarifying some points of Catholic thought on the subject, dealing with natural law theory and with the subject line utilitarianism and sexuality. A month later, a student who was not taking the course, but who had seen the email sent to one of his friends who was taking the course, complained to Howell's department head in the university, arguing that, quote, teaching a student about the tenets of religion is one thing, declaring that homosexual acts violate the natural laws of man is another. Now, the argument itself is very revealing. Religion has no right to deal with moral questions. And meanwhile, the real offense is the suggestion that something is wrong when a lot of people think that it's right. Well, I could tell you about wilder teasing out of all of this. Let me end with a quote from Camille Paglia. She's a bit coarse. You must understand that she is a lesbian, an atheist, but she is honest. She writes, for gays to demand that sincere Christians cease lobbying Washington about the increasing liberal drift of government policy shows colossal historical amnesia. For pity's sake, it was the flamboyant, thunderous activism of evangelical Protestant ministers in the 19th century that powered the abolitionist movement and led to the end of slavery in the United States. Of course, these massively documented facts were concealed in Steven Spielberg's liberal Hollywood light version of Amistad. Similarly, eloquent Protestant ministers like Martin Luther King Jr. and Jesse Jackson have been central in the modern civil rights movement, which secured voting rights for African Americans and opened the way to the election of a rising number of black politicians at the local, state, and federal levels. So gays should quit bitching about Southern Baptists exercising their constitutional rights to free speech about homosexuality, which is indeed condemned by the Bible, despite the tortuous casuistry of so many self-interested parties, including clerics. I have been warning and warning for years of the insulting disrespect shown by gay activists to religion, which has been going on for 20 years virtually unchecked on TV talk shows with their biased liberal hosts, would produce a backlash over time. As a libertarian, I believe the government must stay out of our private lives. As an atheist, I believe the government has no business sanctifying the unions of some persons, heterosexuals, but not others, homosexuals, particularly when certain benefits, such as employer-sponsored spousal health insurance, flow to one group only. As a scholar, however, I am troubled by the provincialism and amorality of the gay male world when compared to the vastness of philosophical perspective provided by Orthodox religion or even by ancient paganism, which honored nature. And as a lesbian, I'm sick and tired of the gay rights movement being damaged by the cowardly incapacity for self-examination of my many gay men friends. Now again, I'm reluctant in some of these topics to say so little. Almost all of them demand that you say more, or else some of you here will think you've got me pegged. Those of us who have been counseling gays for years, we get a certain proportion of them at the seminary, for example. It's inevitable. People talk about these things. And some of them end up as missionaries vowing celibacy for the cause of Christ. And in some cases, they eventually get married, have children, and are happy as marriages go. But they will tell you that even though they've been careful to watch their imagination life and what they read and so on, they will tell you that even though their marriages are stable and even though God has given them some degree of freedom, they will tell you that if they allow themselves to fantasize sexually, they fantasize homosexually. This is a damned world. It's complex. The counseling is complex. The application of things is complex. Some people, when they are converted, are spectacularly freed from things, and others fight it all the rest of their lives. There's not a formula. Statistically, about 80% of homosexual men are not simply homosexuals, they're bisexuals. They go either way. I think those that have been 100% homosexual are far less likely to be freed. But bisexuals, where they're sleeping on both sides, are feeding one side or the other. There is an element of choice to it. No matter how you cut it, there is an element of what you allow yourself to fantasize over. Life is complex. But where are those complexities entered into the public debate today? In my experience, almost exclusively among serious Christian pastors who deal with these things at the local church level. No. I want to suggest some ways forward for dealing with tolerance and intolerance, but I'm going to do so after talking about that woman from Kentucky.